Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you. Welcome to Real Recovery. So glad you joined us tonight. Bill Arnold on this side of the studio and just across the way, a man whose toaster wasn't working properly, then he realized it wasn't plugged in, George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
That can happen. We left the swim bag at the club the other day. I go to get it out of my bag. And
it's embarrassing.
It happens more and more, though, doesn't it?
You know, I felt so sorry for you. Your little toast is in the toaster and nothing's happening, and it wasn't plugged in.
One of my greatest moments as a human being was that fancy store that sells $300 toasters, and went out to eat with another couple, and we go in, and we're like, I said, what kind of a intelligent person would pay $350 for a toaster? I got a bad feeling I'm insulting you now. And the guy said, we just got one. It's like, I mean, there's a toast and a toaster, right? How does that?
Well, I mean, if it makes the toast, turns the bread into toast, it's a toaster.
It's a toaster.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, we haven't missed a beat.
This is
good radio.
No, we haven't. I'm looking forward to tonight. Of all the 12 years we've been doing this show now, George, and the 400-plus guests we've invited on to Real Recovery, I still believe, and I'll say this on record, my favorite testimony is yours.
Well, it's not mine.
Well, I thank you for saying that. That's a good way to start.
Well, it's true. And I think all the stories of the people we have, and one of the reasons I love doing this show, Bill, and working with guys in the addiction ministry as you do at the Salvation Army, is I can't see God, but I can sure see what he does in making dead people alive.
Amen.
And this week, a couple of my guys got, one guy got 2 years, a guy got 18 months. Excuse me, last week, 6 months. And really what that does is it doesn't affect one life. It affects about 15 to 20, because what we're looking at is a guy, and I only work with men, whose kids will never see him drunk. The grandkids will never see him drunk. And you have spouses and parents. And getting there, getting to recovery is painful. And a lot of people don't make it. We've been to a lot of funerals.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, getting into the recovery, one of the big blue recovery books says, my problem isn't drinking, that's a symptom. I'm self-centered, egocentric, and selfish. And it's like, I didn't know that when I read it, but that's our problem. And it manifests itself through addictive behaviors. And a lot of times what people will do, well, I need to quit drinking. Yes, you do, but you need an overhaul that can only be done through the Holy Spirit and God. And most people, like me, realize that when you're sober about a year or two, and you thought that was your big problem, and then you realize, no, my big problem is me, and my solution isn't me. It's not some program. It's not a great psychologist, psychiatrist, so those are necessary. It's God.
Mm-hmm.
And God allows it because he's sovereign. Nothing happens that he doesn't allow. And you think, why is he doing this? Why do I have this? For me, I wouldn't be a Christian if I wasn't an addict. And if we look eternally, you know, a lot of things don't make sense in this life. But if you look at it through eternity and you look at Romans 8:28, that all things work together for good for those who love God and are walking according to his purpose, it makes sense. And for me, when I see these guys, I just talked to one on the way into the studio, there's nothing better for me. And it's really amazing, and I thank God for it, because usually there's nothing better for me than me. And that didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And when you realize, hey, I got to get sober, what God has for you, you don't want to miss this. It's so much bigger than you are. And if you're in recovery, you have a ministry. People see it. They know what you were like before. And I knew when I was about, I don't know, 20 years sober, my friends who wouldn't hang around with me because of my drug use were now calling me because their kids, their most valuable relationship, the thing they value so highly in life, was, you know, they were in trouble. Who do they call? Ghostbusters, right?
Right.
And I thought, thank you, God. There's a purpose for all this. Okay, you talk now. I'm tired.
I will. And George, you've been had 38 years of sobriety. Does that sound about right?
Well, this would be, you know, what trite person I am. It's actually 39, but who keeps track of
it? Well, you keep track, and I'm glad you do, because your recovery story is really one of my all-time favorites, and I want you to tell it tonight, and that has nothing to do with the fact that we couldn't get a guest tonight.
Yeah, and it's this afternoon, though.
Well,
or tomorrow.
Or early the next day.
Early the next day.
Yeah.
Gosh, my story. Well, it's not my story. It's God's story in me.
Let's go back, though, to your introduction to using mind-altering chemicals, alcohol, and that started in high school, didn't it?
Yes, yeah. But I'd like to go back to the age of five, and I was talking to my sister this week, and I didn't realize it was the age of five, but growing up, my favorite thing to play with was my dog. Things actually haven't changed. We had a boxer named Tiger, and he used to lie on the slate floor out in the hall outside my bedroom. And I remember one morning, I'd go out and climb on him, you know, and I saw the light come through the windows. And that's when I first remembered thinking about God. And, you know, there's all these religious theories. There's Arminians and Calvinists. And for me, what I know is I always knew there was a God. I didn't live like it. But going back to that, and the reason I know I was five is I was talking to my sister this week, and I said, do you remember the year that Tiger ran away? I said, I was four. And she looked up because there was a newspaper strike. It was five. So that was kind of the start. And I'll get back to that later, and that will make some sense. Anyway, I loved playing sports growing up. I grew up in a pretty nice suburb, and sports were my thing. We went to church on the weekends. My dad was a Baptist. My mom was a Catholic. So when they had an argument, she went to Mass, and he took us to the Congregational Church. And I thought of it like school because my dad played at a very prestigious country club, golf, and so we didn't go in the summer that much.
To church.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because Sundays were golf day.
Yes. And it is a good golf course, in his defense. So anyway, things went well. I had a pretty good athletic career. I went to a good private school. And I played varsity baseball in ninth grade. Played every inning. The next youngest guys were juniors and seniors. So I was a pretty good ball player. And I played hockey. And that was my whole identity. Well, in ninth grade, we had a championship game against a rival, and I remember the game like it was yesterday. It was a big deal. You know, playing with seniors and stuff. One guy played hockey at Notre Dame, and it was so cool. And, well, my mom got cancer that year. And the night of the championship game, I went after the game to the hospital. My mom had had a radical mastectomy, or mastectomy, what they call it, or she had her left side of her body removed. And this was in 1973. And I remember seeing her lying there, and she was on these machines, and it was shocking. Well, that night I went to a party, and that's the first time I had drank before that I got high from drinking. And I was drinking warm, cold 45 malt liquors. And after four of them, I got the feeling. And I never felt really okay in my life outside of an athletic field until I had that feeling. And I was talking to people, and it's just a great time. And I remember the next day I felt really sick, but I knew I would be doing this again. The next few months I started smoking pot. My parents were divorced, so I kind of raised myself after that with my dad's intervention. From an outsider, and I got hooked by the fall the next year. I didn't play football. I did make the varsity hockey team, which was a big deal. I should have started at a goalie, but I didn't because I was smoking pot every day. I got kicked out of school. After a hockey season, my grades were so bad. Got in arguments with a couple teachers. I shoved a guy, and I got kicked out, a teacher. The summer before I had hit an umpire, called me out at home. I got kicked out of confirmation. There's a pattern here looking back. I was really mad my dad left. Didn't realize it at the time. The addiction was full bore. And I was getting high every day. I would take speed, some hallucinogenics, drinking. But I tried to get every high every day. I got sent to a psychiatric hospital ward at a regular hospital because they didn't really have treatment back then. And I remember I got a huge resentment because I got my moccasins made, and before I had the belt done, they discharged me. So, you know, I never finished the belt. But I had a lot of, yeah, I had a lot of, I did win the pool tournament. And it was kind of like that movie Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
But they gave me great drugs. So I was really in no hurry to get out of there. And my dad came in one day, goes, I'm taking him home. Started a new school, a public school, and I hung out with the drug crowd. I never played baseball again.
Wow, that's a shame.
And I never played hockey again until college. So anyway, we're rolling. I'm going to a school now. I had been to a private school. No girls. We have girls there. We can smoke cigarettes outside. We're getting high between classes. My senior year of high school, I turned 18. That was adulthood because of the Vietnam War. If you can go die in a war, you're an adult. Could write my own notes at school.
Mm-hmm.
Had my own car, girlfriends, part-time job, making money, getting high all the time. Hope you all are, too. And I would go to school. I was on the DECA, Distributive Education Club of America.
Yeah, that's some prestige, didn't it?
I was president.
Okay.
And they had a... district conference, and I had to go because I was president.
How old are you at this time?
18, and 18, I could write my own notes when I was gone. So we would go out. We'd go to school to 11, go have a couple bumps, and then go to my job at my parents' candy company, quality control guy, you know. And I'd do that. Well, I go to the district thing, and I had to do an event, so I did a speech contest. Never had done that before. Had a couple cocktails. I got second. That meant I had to go to state. And so I went to state, and I was getting high in the morning with my buddies at the hotel, and one of them goes, don't you have a speech in a couple hours? And I had forgotten about it, so I started drinking to kind of even things off. So I'm up at this podium with a suit on, and I over-prepared alcohol-wise,
mm-hmm.
And they've got all these business people in the front row, you know, and I'm talking, and after about 30 seconds, I was kind of done, and a guy with a tie on, he, in the front row, one of the judges said, have you been drinking? And I said, yeah, a little, and I just kept going with my talk, and the whole panel's laughing. I did not win the tournament. I did not get kicked out of school. I should have.
Yeah.
And it made a great story for all my buddies in that. Graduated from school, went down to the University of South Florida because it was ranked number 3 party school in the country. Couldn't get into 1 and 2. Disaster. Disaster.
Mm-hmm.
The alcoholism was full bore. Drinking, playing golf every day, going to the beach. Couple guys died down there that you know, were in college. It was wild. It was the late 70s. I came back home, and in the fall, I was working. I was making a ton of money working for a sales place with older guys, and I got drunk on Halloween night at the country club, took my mom's brand-new Cadillac Coupe DeVille with 500 miles on it and hit a telephone pole at 90 miles an hour with no seatbelt on. They came and cut me out. Now, my mom was dying of cancer, and my sister told me later that she drove by the road of the crash, and she wailed because she knew there was no way I was alive. They cut me out. I called. I didn't want them working on me. I'm really embarrassed about this, like not the whole night. And I called my own doctor and said, hey, are these guys okay? It was 2 in the morning. They called them for me. I had a head injury, and I was drunk. Remember that because God shows up later in this, 40 years later. And I left the hospital and went out and partied. The next day I had to go back, get a cast put on my leg. I did something to my neck. I was out of control, and I knew I was dying.
Wow. George, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to continue to hear the story of George. He is 39 years sobriety. Quite a remarkable story. Probably my favorite. Just because I love George, too, and that always makes a difference. But if you have a loved one that is trapped in addiction and they're struggling to find their way out, make sure you send this podcast on to a loved one. They will be truly inspired by the work that God has done in George's life. After a short break, we'll be right back in just a minute. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill and George, we're talking to George tonight about his amazing story of recovery. George, you really left us with a cliffhanger. The last thing you said right before we went to break was you were in a car accident and hit a telephone pole going 90 without a seatbelt. God really preserved your life.
He did. And I got a lot of PTSD about that.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody that I knew was glad that I was alive, but they were so angry and afraid that I was going to die, and I was certain I was going to. So I wound up, all my friends are back at college. I'm at home. I couldn't work. I was really injured, and I would sit around, drink all day, and watch TV. You know, watching Laverne and Shirley cocktailing, really had a thing for Cindy Williams, the brunette in the deal. And I'm thinking, what a loser. My mom's upstairs. She's dying. And things aren't going good. And I had a dog named Heidi. She was a long-nosed boxer, maybe part mastiff. And every day she would come over. You know how dogs put their head on your leg when mm-hmm. you're sitting there and just look at you? And it's funny. It's like in the Bible, it talks about there's angels and are among us. Well, that dog helped save my life because it always made me care about something other than myself and that it was okay. You know, she was okay with me.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so a few months go by. I'm going farther down the loser trail, and I'm hating myself. I'm depressed. I'm thinking of killing myself. And my mom said, you got to get a job. So I get the cast off my leg. I get a job. I'm working at a superette. Things are going well. I'm engaging with people. I'm going home getting stoned, drinking every day. I've lost a lot of friends over this, and a lot of my friends were going away at school at Arizona State and other places out of town. Very lonely time, just trying to survive. And what had happened at the end of high school is our minister had come by one day, and he'd meet with me. His name was Don Asman. And he asked me one day, what's going to happen to you if you die? What do you think? I go, I'll go to hell for sure. And he said, you want to change it? He got his Bible out and was reading John 3, and I got saved. And I had started reading like Peace with God by Billy Graham, and I'd watch Billy Graham, and but I knew
Faith Radio, too, or KTIS.
Well, that was to come in college.
Okay.
And
I won't get ahead of your story.
No, well, what was happening is the Holy Spirit was working on me because I had a real interest to God. And when I would get drunk, I would talk about God and all this. And then I wasn't walking it out. So anyway, I get a job at this superette, and I'm doing okay. And I was talking to one of the guys who owned it, a guy named Kenny. And his brother came over, and he goes, yeah, you're in recovery. And I had to go to treatment. I was court-ordered because of the car accident. So the DOC, the Department of Corrections, that's the greatest evangelical tool in our country, because when they have the threat of going to jail over you, you're going to go to treatment. And I went, and I knew I was an alcoholic. So I got sober, 20 years old, sober. And guy goes, when are you going to go back to college? I go, well, I think I'm going to use if I do. He goes, have you heard of Bethel College? It's a Christian school, and you can't use. I applied. I got in. The first day I'm there, in late August, they have like a pep fest for new students, and I'm there. And I'm still smoking heaters, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some song, and I'm sure it wasn't this, but my take was, clap your hands, stomp your feet. Jesus Christ is really neat. I'm thinking, okay, I got to get out of here. These guys are the biggest bunch of dorks I've ever met. I'm not going to do this. But I got back to my apartment because I didn't live on campus. I had to sign a lifestyle statement that I wouldn't drink, you know, no sex, no gambling, but no smoking. Now, it was really cool. I think the no dancing and all that was good and the drinking and no drugs, but I was smoking. So I got an apartment off campus, and I go back and I'm thinking, God, you got to help me. I can't do this. I overshot the thing. And I had to take a Bible class, and it was on Ephesians. That was Chinese to George F. I didn't know Corinthians, Ephesians, Galatians, any of that. So I dropped the class, and it's getting to be late November, and I'm standing at the student banking window, and I had a real God shot. I'm leaving. I'm getting some money for the weekend. I'm sober. I'm not using, but... And a guy behind me is talking to this good-looking girl that I had noticed when they walked up about a hockey team. And he said, we got a good team. We're going to be MIAC varsity next year. We're going to play club team, but we need a goalie. I turn around and I go, you know, I played. And he goes, where'd you play? I told him. He goes, really? Can you get some stuff? 2 days later, I'm at a practice. A week later, we had a game up in Hibbing. Now, my self-esteem is really low at this point. We played a good team. We lost 4-1. I was the goalie. They had 45 shots. I think they hit the pipe like 15 times. But I played pretty well. We get down for breakfast in the morning, and guy says, you see the paper? And it said, in the paper, Bethel played Hibbing Junior College. They have a good base to build their program on freshman goalie George Fraser. Because a lot of my credits didn't transfer. And I saw that and I thought, okay, there's hope. And I stayed in school. I was sober for a while. My senior year, the summer, I started drinking. I was out with my dad and a couple guys you know at Interlaken. We played golf, which is a country club in Edina, Minnesota. And he goes, you know, I think you could have a couple beers. And he said later, I knew I was wrong when you were on your fourth beer before dinner got there. You know, I was kind of lit. And I went back to school. That was the summer I started doing cocaine. I got a DWI in January. They let me stay in school, which saved me. I graduated. I had periods of sobriety. I got a job selling Listerine, Schick, Efferdent, signed a tap for a company called Warner Lambert. I was going to 12-step meetings, church. Bible study, I was trying, but I would get 3 months in and I would go back. That went on till 1982, and I had to go back to treatment again. That lasted for a month. They wanted me to go to a halfway house. I didn't need to. I was using a month later. I had a nice house in a great suburb. Great job. I had a double life going, okay, right? I got the corporate thing, and then I got the party thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about in the book of James about being a double-minded man, unstable in all you do, toss about like waves on the ocean. And I remember when I read that, that was me. What addiction does is takes many things, but one of them is your identity. And you become who you are around, who you think people want you to be. And I had lost my identity as an athlete. So now I got to get it as making money and being, you know, a big guy. And I always had big manism, you know. And but I was dying inside. And the third treatment, I saw a guy that I knew from high school who said he had found God. And this guy had been a Marine. And he had gone to treatment, I think, 6 months before I did. And his name is Kurt. And I thought, what an act this is, you know, but I loved the guy. And he was a big guy. I was scared of him, but he's a great guy. Well, he's been a minister for 40 years.
I know.
And
I was afraid of him, too.
And you know.
In high school. Oh, yeah.
It's one of the greatest miracles ever.
Mm-hmm.
And when I see him preach in church, you know, the stained glass behind him, and he's such a good speaker. And I think, you know, I know God loves me, too. And it's a special thing. So anyway, I get out of treatment. And I used again September 16th, 1984, and I had to drive up to Fargo, North Dakota the next day for some business. And I'm pulling over at the rest stops, and I'm getting sick. And I had started listening to a guy named Chuck Swindoll, played hockey at Bethel, which saved my life. And the captain of our team was a guy named Greg Sutton. Great football player, great hockey player, and he became my buddy. I had good friends now, you know? And I was trying to be like him, but I was still a little behind it. And they didn't toss me aside. You know, they loved me up. And Sutz said, there's a guy you should listen to on the radio. He's a Marine. He's a minister. Well, Chuck Swindoll, I would listen to every day at 9 in the morning, sometimes 9 at night. And there was a guy at 10 o'clock at 10:30 at night called Bill Pierce, who had this show called Night Sounds with the Debussy lead-in. It was the coolest soundtrack. And he was a big trombone player, but he had a real mellow talk. And
he'd help you drift off to sleep, wouldn't he?
Totally.
Yeah, with some very calming, peaceful thoughts.
And things were working. Well, that was the last time I ever used a mood-altering chemical again.
Wow.
And that was September. I got sober on the 17th, 1984. So things are going good. Everything's going good. I'm going to church. I'm in Bible study. And I knew I was going to go back out. I'm single. So one of the most meaningful nights that ever happened to me, my roommate, my college roommate, is getting married. And he's moving out of my house. I got a huge, it was a huge house. I had huge rent. And I have to go to his bachelor dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, your old girlfriend from college is going to be sitting at the table. I go, you're kidding me. Yeah, she's good friends with my fiance. Oh, good. This will be such a good night. So I go to it. I don't want to go. I'm going to drink afterwards. Done deal. Couldn't stop it, you know. I knew it was coming. So I'm leaving the place, and this good-looking younger woman who was the hostess there says, hey, Joe. And I kept walking. I'm looking around. She goes, hey, Joe. Keep going. She kind of came out from the host stand. She goes, no, you, Joe. I go, my name's George. She goes, I know. Joe, you went to high school with my sister. I go, what? She goes, yeah, you went to high school with my sister, Mary. I go, you're kidding me. So I started talking to her. The phone rings. She goes, hold on a second, at the hostess stand. She goes, you'll never guess who's here. Joe Fraser. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
She's cute, so we're letting it go.
Yeah.
So I started talking to her sister, and she goes, ask my sister out. It's like, why would you want your sister to go out with me? So I did. We went out, saw a movie, went out to eat, and she said she was going to go. She had been in Sweden for a year, and she didn't like the materialism of the suburbs. She was living in her parents' basements, and she goes, what do you think? I go, I think you need to take responsibility for your life and get an education and quit blaming the town and all that. You've had a pretty good grow. I basically think you have to grow up, like trying to not get date number two.
This is you talking to her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
you're not interested in date number two.
Oh, I was.
Okay.
You know me, Bill. It just kind of comes. It's a gift.
Yeah.
So she calls me a couple days later and said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I got to go out of town. I got to take my dog to board it. She goes, my dad wants you to come over for dinner. I told him what you said. He wants to meet you. And I'd be glad to stay at your house while you're gone.
Oh, wow.
So she did. I went over to the dinner. The guy scared me to death. Anyway, we wound up being married for 20 years. And one of the things I got from Annie is she was a runner. And she goes, do you run? Of course I do. So, you know, pack and a half a day. So one morning I'm out running by my house and the sun's coming up and I see the sun coming up and in front of it, I see this person running down about 400 yards away. It was her. And I ran with her. It was just so great. And we ran a mile or so, and she goes, gosh, we just ran that mile in 6.5 minutes. Do you usually do that? And I'm done. Anyway,
yeah.
But what happened was the reason I kept going back to using is I missed getting high. So I would go to church. I would go to Bible studies. I would go to 12-step meetings and work on my recovery. You know, Christian meetings, a lot of them, and but I would fade 3 months, 6 months, 9 months. Well, I got hooked on working out. And I really think what happens when you read the book of Ephesians, it talks about putting off the old and putting on the new. And what God gave me there was, hey, George, what do you like about using? Well, I like to get high. I like to escape. I like to relax. I like to kind of numb out. I like snappy patter. And the one thing I didn't get was getting high. And that replaced that. I started doing triathlons, yoga, and it changed my life. So I was well on my way. Anyway, I know we're coming up on a hard break here, but after we got married, the company I worked at, my family's company, we sold it. And I had a lot of money. And my mentor, Denny, said, you need to get a job. I wound up getting a job at an elementary school playground as a playground supervisor, which I turned into everlasting quarterback at recess for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Best job I ever had.
Yeah, that's hysterical. That part's very funny, thinking of you as a playground supervisor.
No, actually, it's not. It's a good fit. I would have made a better kid participant, but God showed up and changed my life.
All right, we're going to continue our story with George P. Fraser in just a minute. You're listening to Real Recovery. If you've not listened to our program before, we're so glad you're listening now. And George is the co-host of the show, as you know, and he has got, in my opinion, my favorite recovery story. If you want to receive a daily email featuring a scripture graphic, you can sign up for the verse of the day at myfaithradio.com. I think you should do it. I think it's great. And if you want to share your Faith Radio story, is if Faith Radio has become a part of your daily journey with God, we'd love to hear your story. You can share how God is using Faith Radio to encourage you and to help you grow. You can do that also at myfaithradio.com. And we are now going into our 12th or 13th year. I've lost track, George. What is it, do you think?
We're going into 13, I believe, which is
amazing.
Unlucky. We probably don't have much longer.
So we'll be right back in just a minute. Thanks for listening to Real Recovery, Bill and George. We're listening to George's story, and it's an amazing one. George, it sounds like you're now starting to get out of your recovery what you tried to get out of using.
Totally.
Okay. So tell me more about this runner's high, because I always think running is nothing but pain.
Well, what happens is you've got internal endorphins that get released, a little dopamine, a little serotonin, the feel-good things. And it became part of, well, when I was using Coke, I couldn't wait to go do it. And afterwards, I really regretted doing it every time. Going to work out for me, and I still do it, I never want to do it. I swam yesterday at the health club, and there's a giant hot tub before you get to the pool. And every day I got to walk by and go, no, that's a bad neighborhood. Don't go in there.
Right.
But I'm thinking, oh, that's nice and warm. The pool's like 78 degrees, which is a little cold when you get in. But afterwards, I'm always glad I did it. And I never really wanted to get sober. I didn't want to get in trouble. But God gave me the desire to stay sober. I took steps I didn't think would work. I figured they'd work for other people. You know, you hear these guys when you're in rehab. Yeah, we're happy you're recovering alcoholics. And it's so great to come see you. And I always thought they were employed by the treatment center. Because these guys are obviously mentally unstable. Nobody's happy without drinking. I was wrong, and I took steps that I didn't think would work, and I got results I can't deny. So I'm at the playground. I thought it was still Mr. Big. I got a red jacket with a whistle, company issued.
Mm-hmm.
So in Minneapolis, where I live and was working at the time, it gets cold in the winter, and it's probably 2 or 5 degrees out in January. And I'm standing outside with these sixth graders who, you know how sixth graders are. And the one said to his buddy, hey, I'm going to go to Blake School next year. And I said, oh, that's a great school. He goes, how did you know? I go, well, that's where I went. He goes, no, you didn't, because if you did, you wouldn't have grown up to be a loser playground guy.
This is a sixth grader talking.
Sixth grader. So I want to drop this kid, right?
Right.
But I look over at him, and behind him is the glass on the school. And I see my reflection. I got a red jacket on with a name tag and a whistle.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, I think the kid's got a good point here. The next day, I drove up to Hazelden Treatment Center, met with the guy. And I had some ideas for new treatment. This guy met with me as vice president for an hour. And he goes, you have some great points, but you need to get credentialed. So you need to go to school and get a degree. So I went and got a two-year counseling degree. I had a four-year business degree. And then I got a graduate degree testing my treatment theory. And I got a job at Hazelden. I did an internship there. And I was there for a week, and I got a job at the place that I wanted. So I got to put the Harvard MBA type Hazelden on my resume, mm-hmm. and I got to run my own group right out of school. And it was a relapse group, which I like. I don't want to argue with people about whether you have a problem or not, like primary treatment. That's up to you. People have the right to not recover. I'll help you see how well that's working. But I want guys who've tried to get sober and haven't been able to do it. Those are my guys. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I worked there for a few years. I had an affair at 20 years of sobriety, midlife crisis, I don't know. And I left the University of Minnesota Fairview, and I needed to repent. I was ashamed. I lost somebody I loved very much. Didn't treat her right. And I was thinking, if you can't honor the one person you truly love, you got a big problem. And I never thought I would do something like that. And the Bible talks about pride comes before the fall. Let every man take heed lest he stumble. And what I learned from that is I never take my sobriety for granted. Before I get out of bed, I say, God, give me the power, strength, and desire to stay sober today. And that has worked for me. And all those years I didn't make it, I would bring God in at about noon, you know? And I'm very regimented with that. My dog, Bob, knows it's time to get up when I start praying. I still have kind of a loser life, but I'm happy with it. So, I was going to start my own treatment center. Had a dream one night that I don't really remember that well, but I remember I woke up having coffee during my quiet time. I don't want you to do that. I want you to go down in the inner city and not charge for what you're doing.
Do recovery work.
Yeah. So I had to tell the guys, I prayed about it for a couple of days. Obviously, that wasn't my idea. And the guys were pretty upset, but they wanted to honor God because, we had drawn up the plans and marketing stuff. And so I told a few people. Guy calls me, a guy named Joe Camp. Joe had a church in Minneapolis, and he was a Methodist pastor. He said, I heard you want to do something at church. Come on down. So I met with a guy. Well, he became a real good mentor of mine, and I learned a lot from him, and he helped a lot of guys. He gave me an office. He called me 2 days later, and he said, I got a customer for you. Joe was in recovery, met the guy. The guy came up. He's still sober.
Wow.
And so I started, well, one day I went over to the Salvation Army because I said, I'll work with guys. No charge. I know you don't have enough staff. I worked there as a counselor, many years before for a couple years. And guy's name is Bill Price. He's running the place. And he said, our program director is gone, but could you do me a favor? We have a speaker in about an hour in the chapel. You know that gig because you do it on Fridays for 20 years or whatever. He said, could you stand in? I go, sure. Next day, I got a phone call. He said, guys really liked you. Do you want the spot every week? Sure. So nice. I started going down there working with guys. Well, one guy, first guy I worked with on a one-on-one, had been a Lutheran minister. And he lost everything by smoking crack. And I'm working with him, and he said, it was in April. And he said, do you play golf? I go, yeah, I do. Love golf. He goes, yeah, I did too, and haven't played in a few years. He goes, how'd you learn to play golf? I go, my dad taught me. And I go, I got a great story about my dad. I had a great dad. He's playing golf in a pro-am in St. Paul. And the pro in his group was a guy named Lee Trevino. And I was 11 years old, 1968, I believe. And my dad beat him in the pro-am. It's very cool. I was walking around with my buck teeth. My dad beat Lee Trevino. My dad beat Lee Trevino. I couldn't even say it. And he goes, well, we've met before. then. Drunk, drug addict, treatment center. Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
I go, how'd we meet? He goes, well, I had Lee Trevino's bag that week.
Oh, wow.
I go, yeah,
he was
right.
Caddying for Lee Trevino.
He goes, I won a college tournament, and we got to draw in a random draw the bags of the top pros, and I had Trevino. And I'm thinking, yeah, right, buddy. He goes, there was a radio announcer in that group. I still get goosebumps on this. Who was it? I go, Howard Viken. I couldn't believe it. But what it was is God going, I'm here. I've had you. And the guy looked at me and said, so this is 2010. And he goes, that was 1968. He goes, you know what, George? God knew in 1968 that you and I would meet again in 2010. Don't we have a great God?
Amazing. What a story. What a great story. All right, we're going to just take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to hear the rest of George's story, even though we need many more hours to hear all of it. Just we're going to hear how this story gets wrapped up. So you're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Real Recovery, Bill and George. I love hearing George's story. I've heard it many times, and every time I hear it, I feel like I'm hearing it fresh and new for the first time, because I think that's the way when God works in someone's life, that's how it feels. It's a fresh impact.
It is God's story, and I always tell my guys to tell your story once a year so you hear it. So this is helping me more than anybody, because I haven't told it in a while. Anyway, so I wound up working at the Salvation Army, the guy wanted me to interview for a counselor job, and I interviewed with the program director, and there's the HR person, Mr. Price, who was the administrator, the program director, who I knew, she was a volunteer when I had worked there before, really nice lady, and she goes, well, why do you think you're qualified to work here? Okay, I got a master's degree, I'm licensed, nobody else down there was, and I still have a little bit of a corporate edge when meetings come. And I said, well, I think a better question is, why aren't you using the 12 steps? Because that's the best practice. And as Christians, we should do that. Well, that kind of lit the candle.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't like that, and things kind of escalated. And I looked at the administrator afterwards. I said, thanks for the interview. I'm going to assume I didn't get the job. And she and I are friends. It just didn't go well. So a couple weeks later, I go down to speak, and I walk into an office. I'm looking for Mr. Price. A guy named John Hultin worked there. You knew John.
I knew John.
I said, John, I didn't get to meet you really. Sorry, I'm going to be leaving. Could you say goodbye to Mr. Price for me? He goes, well, I don't know if you're leaving. I go, what? He goes, well, our program director resigned today to take another job elsewhere. And she said you'd be the best person to take her job, even though she didn't hire me for a lower job.
Mm-hmm.
I go, that's really surprising to me because I didn't think she likes me. She goes, she went well out of her way to say that, but she thought she'd be the best person and that you guys used to be really good friends and she's okay with it. That's a God shot.
That is.
So I get the job there. And one thing I had forgot to say, one of my biggest regrets in life was when my mom was dying. And I was sober at the time. She needed a ride to the hospital, and I had a racquetball game to play. And I told her I couldn't give her a ride because I was playing racquetball and to get her sister to drive her, and her sister did, and my mom never got out of the hospital. And I carried that for years. That was in 1977. In 2011, I'm working at the Salvation Army. I have to kick a guy out for drinking. This guy had gone to a very prestigious Eastern boarding school and college. He was my age. His mom comes to get him. All his stuff in two garbage bags. He's reeking. Put him in the car. I'm standing there waving goodbye. I'm thinking it doesn't get worse than this.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to buck it up and get back into work, you know. She pulls the car forward, stops, gets out. Comes over and she goes, hi, George, I just want to tell you I was really good friends with your mom and she's been would be real proud of what you've done with your life. That one was lifted. It took 33 years. Anyway, so I go back. I worked there for a while. One day a guy comes in who I knew. He had this play called Triple Espresso. He was from my hometown. I had met him at a speaking deal he did, Rise with the Guys, years before. Didn't really get a chance to talk to him. Always admired the guy. And he came up to me at Salvation Army, and he goes, "I really like how you speak." Now, this guy's a professional actor. And I said, "Could you help me?" He goes, "No, I don't want to mess you up. You're a natural. But I do have a question for you. Why don't you ever speak on holiness?" And I think for one or two times in my life I've said this. "I don't know." And he said, "If I gave you a tape from a guy named Tim Keller, would you listen to it?" It's actually a CD, but I said, "Sure." Well, that got me hooked on it. Anyway, that guy's name is Bill Arnold, the guy across from me. And about a year later, Bill would work down there running a group on Wednesday night and speaking during the week. And we had a guy named Ernie Larson die, who was the recovery guy, and Bill took his spot, and he's had that since, what, 2012, 2011? No misses, you know, and does a great job. We became great friends. He said, "I'd like to do a radio show with you." I said, I remember this. I said, "I have no talent to do that." He goes, "I know you don't. That's why you'll be perfect. Come on, we'll go meet with these guys at the radio station." A guy named Neil Stavem and Dick Whitworth. Neil Stavem. And you did all the talking, and I just was a bobblehead. And they gave us 8 weeks to do a show called Real Recovery. And we did it on Sunday night. Nobody else was here but our producer, Alex Whitworth, who's now at Teen Challenge for many years. And we did the show, and Bill and I went out to eat afterwards. And Bill said to me, "Do you think that was a fraternity prank?"
Thought they'd let us on the air. There was no one here except you, me, and Alex.
Well, and so 4 weeks later, you said, "We got to go over there. They want to meet with us."
Yeah.
And I thought, hey, I never thought I'd get to do it. And they said, "You can do it as long as you want to do it."
It's amazing.
And it was. So anyway, everything was going good. And in 2016, I went in for a physical, and I found out I had stage 4 lung cancer. And I was shook. You were kind of there because you were there. And coughing up blood, and I'm sitting at home one day in February, 2 months into it, and I was so depressed, and I heard God. I didn't hear a voice. He said, "I helped you get sober. I got you now." And I thought, you know, once again, I missed it. If I die in a car accident, I don't get to say goodbye to everybody. I didn't know I had that many friends, and everybody stepped up, no more than you. You know, you were great. And I got on this drug, Keytruda, and I got better. But the reason I share that, a lot of you tonight are listening, are Christians, and want to help people. And I want you to know that what you believe is true. I had always believed it, but I didn't know it. I had peace of mind instantly after that, even though I was dying. And we joke that, you know, I disappoint everyone because I got better. But I know that what I believe is true because of what happened. I got sober. I got saved first. I didn't get sober right away. So if that's you, or it's a lot of us, hang in there.
Amen.
God will do what you can't do.
Amen.
And it's been a great ride.
Yeah. And now how many years cancer-free?
7.5.
Yeah. And that was after you were told you probably had 6 months to live.
At the longest.
Yeah. So God continues to...
That's when you showed up with a measuring tape over at my house.
I did.
Yeah. So, but you were great for that. And I'm glad I went through it. It was a blessing. And you told me to read a book by Tim Keller. And basically what he said in there is... Philippians 4:6-8, "Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything present your request to God with thanksgiving." The reason you do it with thanksgiving is God answers your prayers exactly the way you would if you had the information he does.
Beautiful.
What a deep thing.
George, thank you for your amazing story. Thank you for decades of friendship. I love you, and
yep,
I'm so glad that we can be doing this together. We want to connect with you on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. We're creating encouraging posts every day to help you focus on the important things as you spend time on social media. From graphics that feature Bible verses and quotes from our hosts and show guests, to articles about topics you are interested in, to videos from our hosts. Search Faith Radio on social media sites to connect with us today. That wraps up our show. Thank you so much for joining us. If you have a friend that would benefit from hearing this, you can send the podcast easily. Have a great rest of the day, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.